Welcome to It's Our Money with Ellen Brown, a look behind the curtain of global finance and monetary control with one of the foremost experts in the field. Author of the bestseller Web of Debt and the Public Bank Solution, Ellen Brown's groundbreaking work began the movement to create new American public banks. We'll look at issues surrounding the world of money and the systems and powers that control it, as well as the progress being made on the public banking frontier. The program is underwritten by Public Banking Associates, a national consultancy of experts advising government leaders pursuing creation of their own public banks at publicbankingassociates.com.
That's a myth. It's a terrible myth. It's a disastrous myth that there isn't sufficient public financial resources, public banking resources, to confront the infrastructure needs for green transition. Public banks effectively on their own can do it without having to guarantee private sector profits. Quite often, public banks are quite conservative in their lending, whereas a private bank in the U.S. in particular will lend out $25 or $30 for every $1 they have in reserves. Public banks, at most, lend out $8 for every $1 they have, and public development banks are even more conservative, typically only lending out about $2 or $3 for every $1 they have in reserves.
Greetings, and welcome to It's Our Money with Ellen Brown. I'm Walt McCree, Ellen's co-host and senior advisor to the Public Banking Institute. Today, we continue our conversation with Thomas Marwa, a prominent academic and international expert on the topic of publicly owned banks. When surveying how the almost 700 public banks around the world conduct their affairs and contribute to their local economies, Thomas Marwa emphasizes that the efficiencies found in these banks and the economic impact that enables them to help stabilize local economies should be lanterns for us Americans who are confronting the need for ever more capital investment in infrastructure and new transformative technologies. Ellen will continue her discussion with Thomas today in a few minutes, and we'll also be continuing our historical tour of the Bank of North Dakota, America's only publicly owned bank in the continental U.S., as we talk with author Mike Jacobs about the realities that had to be faced by the upstart Prairie Bank 100 years ago. It's a great history of achievement and democracy that has distinguished North Dakota and powerfully served its citizens and economy. As Thomas Marwa pointed out in our opening clip today, public banks have been shown to be far more conservative in the leveraging of their funds than private banks are. And of course, they're not committed to maximizing profits at all costs. They're driven by a mission of service to their clients, the people and citizens who own them, rather than boosting profits for the sake of fat salaries and bonuses that we become accustomed to in the global private banking industry. Witness to that fact is the over $170 billion in profit that the global private banks made in 2018. Similarly, the notion that public-private partnerships are the solution to investment for our infrastructure needs is challenged by a simple fact, that the private component of the public-private partnership, or PPP arrangement, is that private investors are focused on making profits that are added to the bottom line of costs that have to get paid by the public. Well, this simple and obvious fact becomes more important now that the common conversation has turned toward accepting the historic and perhaps even epic need for dramatic infrastructure investment and transformation. With limited resources of interested private capital for investing in the many upcoming needed infrastructure projects, and the growing cost of the associated debt around private capital, the rise of public banks as methods of creating new money for these projects becomes all the more relevant. So today we're going to focus on the progress and process that's underway in the dynamic emergence of public banking in America. A number of important new legislative initiatives have taken hold, again, from coast to coast, and several of them are intended to address these growing infrastructure needs. Perhaps not surprisingly, California and Washington states are leading these developments and demonstrate a couple of pathways forward that other states will undoubtedly adopt if successful. You'll notice that on our show today, we're bookending a bit of American history and the associated political processes. The start of the oldest public bank in the continental U.S., the Bank of North Dakota, and now the beginning of what may well become the next publicly owned U.S. bank, somewhere perhaps on the West Coast. Let's talk with Ellen about what's happening on the left coast.
It seems almost weekly, but certainly monthly, that new developments are happening within the states and municipalities around the country around public banking. And now it's gotten to a point where you see some real leadership trends happening on the West Coast. Your latest article talks about Washington and California. What we're seeing, I think, is the true inauguration of serious creation of public banks, or at least the initial steps on that. Tell us about what's going on in California and Washington.
We have some new developments here in California. Senate Bill 528 is a state bank bill, a bill for a state-owned bank through the Infrastructure and Development Bank that would allow the Infrastructure and Development Bank that we already have to take deposits. So this would allow it to take the small pot of money it has right now to lend, which is $400 million. And if it turned that pot of money into capital, it could lend $4 billion. So it could vastly expand its ability to lend. Plus, it's proposing to take deposits from local municipalities. So it wouldn't just be state deposits, but municipal deposits. And that would vastly expand its resources. And presumably, it would grow over time into a major bank.
Does that mean that they're turning this infrastructure bank, which has been a revolving fund like most of them in the world, or in this country anyway, into a depository bank, which means that it can leverage its capital?
Exactly. So that's okay. The plan. And we have another bill that was filed last month, which is municipal bank bill, or it was filed by the California Public Banking Alliance, which is eight advocates in eight cities in California, in order to get a special charter for a public bank, because we've often said that many of the requirements for a regular private bank just shouldn't or wouldn't apply to a public bank. So that one's been filed, but the news on SB 528, which is the infrastructure bank bill, which was filed in February, last week it actually passed its first Senate committee. So it was the Governance and Finance Committee, and next it will go to the Banking Committee. So that, and I actually was tapped at the last minute to go testify, which I did. So I got to see the workings of legislation up close, which is really kind of frightening.
they have
these bills that are an inch thick on their desk that they get like the day before, and they're supposed to vote on them, and they obviously don't know much about what they're voting on. So it does take all sorts of backroom talk and lobbying going on and such, and to have lobbyists, you need money. So I can see right there why all the bills favor people with money, because if you don't have somebody in there wheeler dealing for you, then your bill is probably not even going to be understood, and the opposition is probably going to prevail. So anyway, that was a bit frightening, but as it happened, our bill passed. So that was great, and we're hoping for, you know, that it'll keep moving on. It was brought by Ben Hueso, who was an assemblyman in 2011 when he brought the first state-owned bank bill in California. And that one passed both houses of the legislature. Of course, it was all the Democrats voted yes and all the Republicans voted no, but we had a Democratic majority, so it passed. But Governor Jerry Brown vetoed it. And it wasn't because he said that he thought it was a bad idea. It was because it was for a feasibility study. And he said we didn't need another Blue Ribbon Committee. That's what it was seeking. I guess they're expensive. He said we could do it in-house in the Banking Committee. But, of course, we never heard anything more about it after that. So this time, Hueso, now a senator, is skipping right over the feasibility study and going right for a state-owned bank on the theory that it'll take a couple of years to get a master account from the Federal Reserve anyway, and during that time we can be exploring all these various issues with people that are drawn right from the iBanks. So people who have the numbers, that's one. We always get stalled on these feasibility studies, and one reason is they get farmed out to supposedly independent experts who don't really, we think, they don't really grasp the concept of a public bank, and they don't necessarily have access to all the numbers. So they just base their findings on what other people have said and what the Bank of North Dakota does and that sort of thing, rather than really peering into what the possibilities are in this particular case. So that's what this bill is hoping for, that a committee from the iBank itself can look at it. And one advantage is right now, Gavin Newsom, our new governor, supports a state-owned bank, and he supports doing it through the iBank. So where there's a will, where there's political will, it's a lot easier to find a way. You know, if somebody from above says, I want you to look into this and I want you to figure out how to do it, you're much more likely to get it. That's what happened in L.A. when president of the city council, his legal counsel were advised saying, well, you'll have this problem and that problem with setting up a bank and a city-owned bank. And he said, we'll decide whether we're going to do it. He said, we just want you to tell us how to do it. So if Governor Newsom, you know, goes to the iBank people and says, we want this bank, we want you to tell us how to do it, how we can pull it off, then it's a lot more likely to get done.
So let's talk for a moment about the difference that making the California Infrastructure Bank, the iBank, into a depository, what it's going to do and what will it do with that department. You talked about the maximizing leverage. What will its mission be? That won't change at all. It's infrastructure development.
That's one reason it's a much easier sell than a broad thing where we might be talking about taking individual deposits or marijuana deposits or something like that. In this case, the infrastructure bank already makes infrastructure and development loans. Their clients are only municipal governments or public entities. So they're very safe customers. They know their customer already. They know they're going to pay. They've got a tax base. Even those rare occasions where a city has gone bankrupt, they still manage to, they don't go out of business. You know, it's not like a business that disappears. They're there, they've got a tax base, and they eventually come up with the money. And right now, the Infrastructure and Development Bank has 30 times more demand for its loans than they're able to make. So the market is there. That's not a problem at all. All they have to do is attract deposits and attract some capital or build up some capital. And of course, they've got that. They have the $400 million that they can use for bank capital. So they can make $4 billion in loans. They just have to attract several billion in deposits. But we think they can do that. They'll offer a better interest rate. We have worked out the numbers, and from what we can see, they can offer a better interest rate than the cities are getting now. Of course, they're getting virtually nothing now on their deposits. We can offer them a low interest loans. So it's a good deal for the cities, and the iBank already has a 15-year track record of success. They have experienced staff. They have detailed procedures. So it's a pretty low-risk move, and seems to us that it could well be a winner. We're hoping it's a winner.
Yeah, and certainly a wonderful model that we know is being looked at from around the country. There are a number of states on the East Coast that I can mention that are looking at something similar. Our colleagues have discovered is that municipalities, let's say in the state of Massachusetts, a significant majority of them are unable to get the kind of capital that they need for their infrastructure projects. Not available in the private capital markets for a variety of reasons. It's costly, and sometimes these municipalities, and maybe even more often than not, they're very much close to the limit on how much money they are constitutionally allowed to borrow. So having a capital-rich resource like the iBank, the California iBank, should really change that frontier altogether. Pretty exciting example. But there's another one that's kind of built around the same sort of thing that you talked about in your article, and that is the state of Washington. Tell us about what's going on with that and the ways in which that one's different.
Yes, well, they're actually ahead of California in terms of, Senator Hueso, Bob Hasegawa has been bringing bills for years. He filed his first one in 2010, and now they're up to their fifth bill. But along the way, they've acquired 23 senators in their caucus, which is three votes away from a majority of the Senate, and they've managed to get $480,000 for a business plan. They too are jumping over the feasibility study and going right to the business plan, and so they have a lot of momentum. And their model too would partner with the local banks. So it's called a co-op bank, but that would allow it to vastly expand its resources in terms of deposits and capital. So it's pretty much the same model. So the states are sort of neck and neck in who will get there first. Their business plan is due in June, so June 30th. So we'll be real interested to see that.
And then one other item that you also mentioned in that article that is one in the California Assembly, number 857, and that is distinctly different than the iBank bill. It's one that has to do with enabling municipal banks on the local level.
Right, but I think it would also help the iBank if there were a special charter for a public bank. I mean, it's for any type of public bank, but it's specifically the municipalities that are interested in it or the advocacy groups for the municipal bank.
This would help basically at the Department of Business and Institutions, right?
Right.
Where the bank charter, the state bank charter, is created, this bill would facilitate that. And what kind of things would it do for, let's say, the city of San Francisco or Los Angeles? What would this new assembly bill accomplish?
Well, as I read the bill, it's not real specific about what changes would be made or what would be allowed, but it is enabling legislation, enabling them to form a public bank. So it would set aside this question of whether they're allowed to lend the public credit, you know, that's been an issue because there are constitutional provisions that go back to the 1850s that say something like the, you know, city can't lend its own credit, as if that means they can't have a bank or they can't make loans, but they certainly make loans. They already make loans. So we're only talking about expanding what they already do. So I presume they'll, you know, the language will go through the sausage factory and come up with more specifics.
Well, Ellen, we've been at this for almost 10 years. It's 8 years, I guess, and counting from some point. There was a stage in which we had to tell people what public banks were, and we still have to do that because it's not a household term just yet. But now we're at that stage in this sausage-making process where the legislators are starting to get the drift that there's really an opportunity here, and they're looking at ways in which they can bring it forward without having to have mystery and obfuscation also in front of them as they move forward with trying to get access to their money. It's an exciting time.
Right, and I think the fact that we have this young millennial group very motivated that are demanding change, but legislators are taking stock of that. They're paying attention, and they can see that these are young new voters, that they want something. So the political climate is right for this now, whereas it probably wasn't in 2010 and 2011 when the first bills were brought.
And the centennial year of the Bank of North Dakota.
Right.
Yeah, so it's a great year for that. Well, thanks for this report, Ellen, and we look forward to hearing conversation with Thomas Marwah, the second portion of that, because public banks are happening all over the world now. There's a real growth behind that franchise, and so we'll hear more about it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Today, we're completing the conversation that Ellen started last time with Thomas Marwah, a renowned global expert on public banks. We pick up with a topic just mentioned in my conversation with Ellen about financing infrastructure and how a public bank can dramatically improve the sources of capital needed for infrastructure investing. One shining example of that is found in Germany, where the public bank consortium called KfW has provided the majority of funds for moving that nation's energy generation infrastructure to renewables, which now produce the majority, 65%, of Germany's electrical power.
I did have a question on KfW. I wrote about it some, and I saw that their bonds were selling at 2%, and they were going like hotcakes, like there's a big demand for them. But then you see that public-private partnerships, they want something like 12%, or I saw somewhere for solar on the private market, you get financing at 10%, or you know, something quite high. So why is it that people are eager to buy these green bank bonds or development bank bonds, investors? Is it because they're backed by the government and they can use them for collateral, maybe for repos or that sort of thing?
Yeah, I mean, whether or not they use them for collateral repos, I couldn't say. But basically, yeah, the KfW bonds and a lot of the, you know, the big northern development banks or banks, basically their bonds are, you know, as good as cash. They're not, they're backed by the government, they're guaranteed by the government, so they know they won't default. And so you'll get large institutional investors purchasing them, or other banks, or other, you know, anybody who's looking for a stable investment will pick up on these, and particularly, you know, pension funds or institutional investors that have mandates where they have to have a range of different investments, more stable, more risky, you know, to try to, you know, provide some sort of return for their members, will pick up on these, like they will government bonds. So they're you know, very, very similar to that. You know, I can't say with certainty, but I would say there's probably going to be growing interest in this type of green bond as we get more sustained, more widespread commitments to the Sustainable Development Goals and to trying to reduce greenhouse carbon emissions. So the institutional investors in particular are going to be looking for some sort of investment that has some kind of connection to reducing carbon emissions. And so these types of green bonds are becoming more, I suspect, more and more popular. But you know, investing in a PPP is a very high-risk venture, and which is why, I mean, why, you know,
they
you're going to find less investors, and you're going to find less of the big institutional investors involved.
Mm-hmm.
But also it underwrites it emphasizes why it's so important that public banks are more involved in infrastructure, because PPPs are typically around infrastructure, health, education, roads, energy, and so on, but are very, very costly, very uncertain. The contracting conditions of them are terrible. France has basically said recently, the finance ministry said, it will never do another PPP. They've banned them effectively in France. A very disastrous sort of strategy of financing development. But unfortunately, you know, this is what's being picked up in the SDGs, and the way in which existing public banks are being mobilized within the new Sustainable Development Goals in the UN is essentially a reworking of the PPP's agenda. They want the strategy that's coming out of the Financing for Development agenda is that public banks basically underwrite or socialize the risks involved in PPPs, the logic being that they can leverage more private resources based on the argument that there are not sufficient public funds out there to support the infrastructure, the future infrastructure we need. So we need to do these kinds of PPPs. And again, bring us partly where your first question is, what are the extent of public banks? That's a myth. It's a terrible myth. It's a disastrous myth that there isn't sufficient public financial resources, public banking resources, to confront the infrastructure needs for green transition. Public banks effectively on their own can do it without having to guarantee private sector profits. There's sufficient capacity for them to do this. And they can build that up too. As I'm sure you're aware, quite often public banks are quite conservative in their lending, whereas a private bank in the U.S. in particular will lend out $25 or $30 for every $1 they have in reserves. Public banks, at most, will, the universal ones will lend out $8 for every $1 they have. And public development banks are even more conservative, typically only lending out about $2 or $3 for every $1 they have in reserve. So UNCTAD, the United Nations Commission for Trade and Development, recently wrote a paper saying basically, these multilateral, public multilateral banks and development banks should ease up a bit, extend their lending, extend the amount of resources they're handing out or using, and this can be a means of us confronting these big challenges like green transition, the Green New Deal, by building up public capacity and then minimizing this mythology, or effectively minimizing or providing alternative anyways, saying that we have to do things through PPPs and that we have to guarantee private finance profits in order to fulfill our public infrastructure needs in the future and to decarbonize the economy. It can be done. It's a matter of political will.
Wow, that's really interesting. So I can see where you could obviously extend loans for building any sort of infrastructure that's going to pay back the loan. But many people have raised the point that a lot of the infrastructure we need is not of the self-funding sort. It's like, repairing the roads, which is not going to pay any money back. So how would you recommend funding that? It seems to me that we need to get some new money in the whole system and that we should get that from the central bank, basically quantitative easing for infrastructure. What's your thought?
Again, another really big question. You like to give me hard ones. there's two ways to do this and two ways that it's done. And one is through direct government deposits or contributions to a public bank. So that can be something like quantitative easing, where central bank can essentially create money and lend that through to other public banks, development banks, etc., that can then work on essential infrastructure needs. And so instead of direct public spending, use public resources through a public bank, which then can magnify them 2, 3, 8 times to then continue work on these infrastructure needs at a reduced rate, et cetera. And if that particular project, whether it's filling potholes or building a school where, it's not mandated, there's no reason why that should be cost recovery in any means, it's covered by government transfers. So essentially the government, however they want to do it, covers the expense of that loan. That is the history of development banking in many countries, is that simply they mandated the public bank to do Project X, the bank did it, government paid them, and it was managed.
The advantage then is that you can get it for lower interest.
Yes, the advantage is that you can take that injection of public money, whether they create that money through quantitative easing or simply a budget allocation, you deposit it in the bank, say $1 million, and the bank can lend out that amount straight away or lend out more than that. And if there's a loss, the government just covers that loss for the bank, either in terms of an interest rate loss or the direct allocation of that capital, one way or another. So it's a budgeting feature. So that's one way. And so that's sort of a direct injection type of funding that you sort of started there with. So you can do it through central banks as well. Central banks themselves have a long history before neoliberalism of engaging in development financing, or central banks can work through their regional development banks to promote infrastructure funding. So that way, sort of more of a direct line. There's another way too that can be practiced alongside this or at the same time, and partly to do with the returns or self-financing, however you want to call it, of the public bank itself. So over time, you can generate small returns or large, depending on the bank, and use the profits, the returns that the bank has made to fund their priority projects themselves, so through their own returns. So in the case of something like KfW, they've got substantial returns, and they're making billions of euros a year in profits, and then they plow those back into different projects. So it's sort of returns, or drawing on your own returns. So that's one model as well. It's fairly modest because they're not mandated to be profit maximizing at all, just to sort of basically sustainable. So they make a little bit of profit every year. But there's another way too that I'm increasingly in favor of. And this is more the case in the Global South and more the case with the universal public banks, the banks that combine both development and the commercial retail services. So they'll have savings accounts and credit cards accounts, and they'll offer home mortgages and so on. But at the same time, they're engaged in infrastructure and other development projects with SMEs and so on. And I actually believe, contrary to much of what's being written, that these banks should engage quite directly and competitively with private banks and essentially use through their retail services, services that people use anyways, their savings accounts, their credit cards and everything, the profits they use on that side of their retail services to cross-subsidize and offer quite reduced savings on the development side. So basically, enter into competition with the big private banks, take over their markets, earn some returns from that, and in terms of your day-to-day services, and use that to fund development. It's the model that's practiced quite widely through India, through Turkey, through much of Latin America, where there's a direct and explicit cross-subsidization between profit-making services, so a credit card that somebody uses anyways, and their development projects. That's the model that the Banco Popular in Costa Rica uses, where they generate profits through their day-to-day services that they give to people and to their community, and then use the profits from that, or a good portion of it, to fund social development, social housing, support groups, et cetera, et cetera. I don't personally, and this is my opinion, some evidence, but behind that there's no reason why public banks should not actually enter into competition with private banks. Why not? Why should only private banks be able to profit off of somebody holding a savings account or somebody holding, using a credit card to buy the things they're going to buy anyways, when people ought to be able to decide, I would rather have my credit card, my savings account, and my mortgage with this public bank, knowing that the money, the returns from that are going to be used for the public interest. The profits are going to be plowed back into my community. You can feel good about that rather than, bumping up the salaries of executives on Wall Street and driving higher and higher stock market returns and essentially bolstering, financialization at a global level by using most of our day-to-day services in private banks when there's no reason why that shouldn't be done through a public bank or community bank or a cooperative bank, which is quite common throughout much of Europe and around the world. Mm-hmm. So that would be the second part of a way of funding this infrastructure, is simply by generating returns on a more, let's say, commercial side of the business, your day-to-day operations.
Mm-hmm. On costs, we've done different business models, and we have trouble duplicating how the Bank of North Dakota does it. I heard from a Spark Cousin man that they don't hire seasoned bankers, that they hire new recruits, and they train them themselves. So, for example, we did a model on the current California Development Bank, turning it into a depository bank. Well, their loan officers are getting $200,000 a year. But it seems to me, we're talking about refinancing the government's own debt. So it looks pretty simple. You know who the client is. All you're going to do is take their bonds and refinance them. It's not obvious to me why a loan officer should make so much more than a teacher or a nurse or somebody who also has heavy responsibilities and has to do a lot of thinking on their feet. Anyway, It just seems to me that maybe arguably what we need to do is sort of downsize the expectation of the people that are working at these banks too.
Absolutely. And that's one research project I would love to do, which is basically go around looking at different public banks that exist in the world to have a better sense of why people stay employed at them in effectively. I've done a little bit of it, and I've asked this question a few times around the world, you know, because quite often it is the case, and not necessarily that public banks will, officers and staff will earn less than private banks. Staff. And I've gotten different responses. So I've done a lot of work in Turkey and with their public banks. And quite often the answer is that, well, yeah, I know I could quit my public bank job and go work in a private bank, but working conditions are better, for example. There's less pressure to commercialize my services. I don't need to be pushing loans on people every day, and I don't want to go do that in a private bank. They also feel that there's a sense of belonging and a community ethos. So quite often I've had responses that people working in the bank say, I like the respect that I get for the job that I have. People know the role that we play in our community, and I feel that I contribute to that. Elsewhere, you get different assets. For example, in India, where the public banks are the dominant banks in the country, controlling the bulk of public banking assets, and they're also quite unionized. So essentially, bank workers have, in public banks, have played a role in maintaining a balance between public and private rates of pay, so that they don't get like super high rates either in the private or in the public, and they try to minimize that. And, final example that really stood out to me was in Uruguay. It's the National Public Bank of Uruguay. And, again, there are certain benefits that are not tangible in money terms from working in the bank. I went and visited their bank workers union, and essentially they invited me in, we went to their office, and it was in a community center that they provided as a public service to their employees as part of the bank, a pool and an exercise gym, and it was a community center for bank workers themselves. So there are other sort of non-tangible things that had to do with, when push came to shove, about a public ethos, that the bank is not simply about maximizing returns, not simply about selling every single ridiculous product that comes on its shelf, but doing something for your community that is, in a sense, a public service, and being treated fairly for that and properly as an employee, as a worker.
Mm-hmm.
You're exactly right. It's about creating a different ethos, and that's difficult. Our universities are not set up that way. We're, in terms of finance and banking, and even in terms of public sector management, there's been radical change in the last 20 or 30 years, that everything we're taught is about cost reduction, return risk benefit analysis. It's about maximizing the return of the bank, about maximizing your own, your own value, and trying to press for higher and higher wages, and so on. We need, there has to be a real cultural shift, and so changing mentalities. And I think that is probably, I think it's a great strategy. I haven't heard that from Sparkhausen, where they bring in their own new recruits and develop themselves. Seems to me that might be the only way to do it. It's to create, a belief in what you're doing and a sense of commitment to your community.
Yeah. Can you tell people where to find your work?
Sure. If you're interested in anything I've been saying or writing on this topic, you can go to my staff webpage at SOAS, S-O-A-S, University of London Development Studies. You can just Google Thomas Marwa and look under my publications, and there's quite a bit of work there.
Okay. Well, it's great talking to you. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Ellen. And we wish you and the public banking movement, the greatest of success.
That's Thomas Marwa, spelled M-A-R-O-I-S, at the University of London. The Bank of North Dakota, our only continental U.S. public bank, is celebrating its 100th anniversary this year, as you may know, and its history is quite a story. In our previous visits with our guest, Mike Jacobs, historian and author of the official Bank of North Dakota Centennial book and former editor of the Grand Forks Herald, Mike told us about how the bank was a mere afterthought for North Dakotans who had taken over their government to make an impact on their economic concerns. We learned that not only was the bank not their top priority, it wasn't even on their agenda, but it also had to undergo the strong opposition of state and national banks and the Red Scare following World War I and the Bolshevik Revolution. The fear and resistance to the idea of socialism, more commonly grouped at that time with communism, helped make the bank's beginning all the more fraught. As Mike pointed out last time, there are inescapable comparisons to today's efforts regarding creation of public banks as well. But things finally started to change for the Bank of North Dakota after the founding political entity, called the Nonpartisan League, was removed from office, and subsequent bank management changes took place that helped to build confidence in the institution. But as Mike points out in his dedication to the Centennial book, he credits the 1921 voters who removed the League from government leadership but voted to save the bank and other publicly owned economic institutions with the credit for saving the bank from extinction. Now we pick up the story of the bank a couple of years later, just before the Great Depression.
At the end of the 20s, not completely concurrent with the national economic collapse, but one was not the cause of the other. the new administration, the conservative administration that followed the Nestos, then the Sorley administration, the new administration was much more conservative and really clamped down on the bank, so that it was really not doing very much of anything at the end of the 30s, which gave Bill Langer the opportunity to. And he had been a big critic of the way the bank was operating in its early days. It gave him a chance to come in and remake the bank as a kind of a populist institution with much less stringent credit policies than Nestos and Green and their immediate successors had posed. So that sort of change, in the 30s were very turbulent politically in North Dakota. The state had four governors within a few months, for various reasons that we don't need to get into. But the point is that the very severe economic crisis allowed Langer to escape this notion that somehow the bank was a Bolshevik, anti-American, anti-capitalistic, anti-credit kind of institution, and to resurrect it, so to speak, as a tool that he could use to ameliorate some of the conditions that existed in North Dakota at the time. So his approach to the bank was to provide easier credit, a very large number. I suppose if somebody wanted to sit down in every county seat in the state and look at the land records, you could count the number, but it would certainly be several thousands of farms were saved because Langer and his bank manager, whose name was Frank Vogel, their mission statement was save every farm that you can. So unless the debt load and the management was of the individual farm was completely irredeemable, so to speak, the bank carried them. And the eventual outcome of that was that the bank kept mineral acres as security. And so a lot of farms survived, but the mineral ownership was severed, so that the mineral ownership went to the state, to the bank specifically. And that, of course, is of enormous importance in today's North Dakota economy because the state, the minerals have since been transferred to a different fund. They're not managed by the state anymore, but they were initially. The mineral income to the state is enormous, and not through the state's ownership of mineral acres, not just through taxation, but also through the royalty payments coming into the state. In my family's case, the farm was saved, but the mineral acres, the state kept half of the mineral acres as a condition of the mortgages that the bank gave.
So it actually extended credit based on the future worth of the minerals that were in the ground.
That's not quite right. It extended The reason that Langer became the kind of legendary figure that he did in North Dakota was that he and Frank Vogel were willing to extend credit on the quality of the individuals who were on the farm. In other words, the instructions essentially were to the loan officers, who were out in the country dealing with people. The instructions were, save the farm if you possibly can. And, there was some sense that there was value in the land beyond the surface ownership, beyond its productive capacity. But certainly in 1933, 1937, there was no notion that there was a huge reservoir of oil that could be tapped and that could benefit the state. But unlike minerals are severable under North Dakota law, and so that was something that the state could use as sort of, you have to give us something. We're not going to take the farm, but you have to give us something. And virtually every creditor to the bank, every agricultural creditor, was more interested in being able to plant the crop than they were in some illusory mineral interest that lay almost 2 miles below the surface of the earth. given that choice in 1937 or 1942 even, you'd invariably take the farm. But it didn't just end there, though. I mean, Frank Vogel redeemed government warrants at par while private banks were discounting them. So many, many, many political subdivisions were unable to pay their teachers, for example, or their clerks. They just didn't have any tax revenues. And so they gave them warrants on the Bank of North Dakota, which by law had their deposits, and the bank redeemed those warrants at par. So, in other words, if I had a $100 warrant from the Wabak School District and I presented it at the bank, they gave me $100. If I presented it at the branch of the Minneapolis Bank in Minot, they gave me $90 or whatever it was that they took as a transaction fee. So clearly, Langer and his administration, it's a very turbulent time in the state. There were multiple attempts to derail the Langer administration, and some successful and some not. But the point I'm making is that Langer saw the bank as a way to not just to stabilize the state's economy, but to make a difference in individual lives, in the lives of creditors and in the lives of employees who held warrants from bankrupt political subdivisions. It made an enormous difference during the Depression when North Dakota was particularly hard hit, again, because it's a pretty tough environment, a pretty tough agricultural environment just on this to begin with, and then to be a long ways away and to have money problems just made it all the worse. So Bill Langer became, although he had been at first very suspicious about the motives of the bank, he recognized he became politically active again probably in 1927 or 28. He was elected governor in 1932. He recognized that there was a way that the bank could be used to both to his own political benefit, but also to the benefit of the state, which, of course, like Huey Long, he always, who was his political hero, he saw those two as the same thing.
So it really was a very steady stabilizer for the state economy and backed up the people in ways that private bankers weren't in a position to do. And you had 850 banks in the state that were going out of business during that time.
Right. The banking crisis in North Dakota really started in the 1923 or so, when agricultural prices were already trending down sharply, and lasted really until the end of the 1930s, when war production ramped up, and all of a sudden there were people working again on railroads, but the state lost a very large portion of its population in the 1930s, and in fact it wasn't until 2010 that the census showed the population in 1930 in North Dakota was surpassed at last in 2010 rather. So the population went down sharply, and it took 80 years for the state to recover to the population level that it had at the beginning of the Great Depression.
Wow. So you have this continuing institutional anchor for the state's varied and challenging times. Bank maintains its existence through all of this high water, literally and otherwise, by doing simple banking. Yeah?
Yes. During the 20s and 30s, you know, the bank was largely a farm credit bank, and you know, making farm loans, agricultural loans, often production loans. You know, the difference is that because the bank was essentially backed by the full faith and credit of the state of North Dakota, whatever that was worth in the 1930s, it was able to carry farm borrowers, whereas a private bank would not be able to do that. I mean, they needed to be paying off their investors and their various other enterprises, whereas in the Bank of North Dakota, as long as the state was solvent, it could extend credit, and did so.
So Mike Jacobs has been recounting for us how the Bank of North Dakota not only survived its various existential challenges, political and economic forces, but how it proved to be a uniquely capable partner with the stressed residents and farmers of the state during so many severe downturns in weather and economy. This history perfectly illustrates how having a financial tool that belongs to the people can support the unexpected and uncontrolled outside forces that inevitably come their way. How many other states were able to find a financial savior for their creditworthy citizens when market forces like the fiscal depression and devastating weather events occurred? Similarly, note that having the full faith and credit of the state enabled the bank to secure land ownership and its residents despite the lack of cash to satisfy what would otherwise be typical bank demands under such stressed circumstances. We can certainly reference what happened to the millions of Americans who lost their homes during the Great Recession that began in 2008, again, except in North Dakota, where that state weathered the financial storm with barely any losses. As we discuss the current drive to establish public banks, we should make a note of this, since, as weather and planetary circumstances demand increased resilience, it's a kind of resilience that only public interest institutions can sustain. In a future installment of this story, Mike Jacobs will tell us of other instances of how the Bank of North Dakota provided incomparable flexibility and security. But before we close out this visit with Mike and our centennial retrospective of the Bank of North Dakota, I want to share an amusing side note from Mike's centennial book of what happened when North Dakota went to Wall Street in 1923 to square up some misunderstandings about who these revolutionary farmers were out there on the prairie, as their governor took the matter of trust and responsibility out of the discussion of ideological stereotypes and brought it home to the reality that Americans really do depend on each other.
You say, when you're talking about the ideological framework for trying to move the bank's credit forward nationally, you note that Mestos took the case for North Dakota's industrial program outside the state, and in 23, 2 years after the general recall election, into his first term, he spoke to the Chamber of Commerce in New York, in the state of New York. And his talk was titled The Spirit of the Northwest, and he apparently wasted no time getting to the point, which was, quote here, many of your leaders in industry, commerce, and finance seem to have formed the opinion that the farmers of Minnesota and the Dakotas are socialists, Bolshevists, communists, and red radicals politically, ignorant barbarians socially, and on the way to the poorhouse financially. And this opinion is reflected in much of what is being said and printed in your city about the Northwest. Nestos continues, suggesting, the farmers of the Northwest naturally resent the misinterpretation of their political attitude, as much as you gentlemen, I'm sure, resent the opinion concerning the businessmen of New York, held in some parts of the West, where a large proportion of the people honestly believe that you are a band of crooks, high binders, and financial pirates who operate through Wall Street to deprive the laborers and farmers of the country of that which is their just due.
That's the guy could talk, eh?
It's putting it right on the line.
Yeah. Yeah, and this is a Norwegian immigrant, came as a teenager, didn't speak any English, you know, essentially made good on the American promise, became a lawyer, a community builder in Minot, and somebody who had the courage and the conviction to go to New York and say, you guys are full of it. we're managing our affairs, and you're mistaken about our motives, basically, which I think is an important point, because the Bank of North Dakota was seen as a tool, and it didn't arise because people who thought it was a good idea wanted to create a kind of socialist utopia. They wanted to create a tool that would help them in their individual efforts and help them to build the state and create something that they could pass on to new generations. And the idea of a public bank appealed to them because it solved important problems that the existing banking system was unwilling to address. And the fact that it's a state-owned bank is due more to the desire, the recognition that acting in common, they would be better off than going as supplicants or beggars even to any outside institution. You know, that's socialism by definition, but it's not un-American by any stretch.
That's Mike Jacobs, author and historian of the Bank of North Dakota's centenary book entitled The Bank of North Dakota, From Surviving to Thriving, the First 100 Years. Our thanks to Mike for telling us this story, and we'll continue in future editions on It's Our Money. You can find this excellent and engaging book by visiting the Bank of North Dakota website at www.bnd.nd.gov or by visiting your local bookseller or Amazon. To be continued. And to close out our program today, here's a short little musical piece from Swami Beyondananda that embodies the growing feeling that perhaps public banks are what we need right about now.
California's a failure because we haven't got a bank.
Well, what would you do with a bank if you had one?
Do? If California had a bank?
We could rightly use what's ours to cultivate the flowers and clean our septic tank. We could trade unemployment for service and enjoyment if we only had a bank. When we're stuck and need some credit and Wall Street says forget it, we won't be in the tank. We could pass on lesser offers, borrow cash from our own coffers if we only had a bank. Oh, why? Tell me why. The economy hit the floor. We're sinking lower than we sunk before. And all the jobs, they've gone offshore. We can stimulate production, construction, and instruction by standing for this plank. Just 11 million voters will be like North Dakota, we'll finally have a bank. If we get up off our assets and get the folks to pass it, we'll finally have a bank.
Well, that's it for this edition of It's Our Money with Ellen Brown. Our thanks to our guests, our sponsor, Public Banking Associates, and to you for listening. Be sure to check out Ellen's latest writings on the economy and the changing world of money by visiting ellenbrown.com. And for more information on public banking, visit publicbankinginstitute.org. For information on how local and state government leaders can obtain professional insight and counsel about public banks from key national experts, visit publicbankingassociates.com. I'm Walt McCree. See you next time on It's Our Money with Ellen Brown.